Okay, so we begin this morning in Meretz Hashem with Gehenna. We're going to spend today and Wednesday speaking about Gehenna. And although it doesn't sound like the type of topic that one would like to spend too much time on, we're going to see it's quite fascinating. So let's begin. Number one, Gehenna Omer. What does Gehenna say? Ki hispia nefesh shokeka v'nefesh re'iva milei tov. So again, Gehenna quoting a pasuk from Tehillim, for he has satisfied the longing soul and has filled the hungry soul with good. So we're going to discuss exactly what this pasuk means and try to understand this pasuk in relation ultimately again to Gehenna. But for now, we'll just go ahead and focus on the concept of Gehenna in general. So what's incredibly important to understand is we know this concept of Gehenna. What's Gehenna? Excellent. So remember again, I want to draw your attention to a fundamental distinction between our concept of Gehenna versus, let's say, the Christian concept of hell. Two very different ideas. The Christian concept of hell, that's why even those who use that word as a definition for Gehenna, it's not true. Hell is a religious concept where ultimately, again, people are sent for punishment. Remember, again, hell in Christianity is associated with sainted. We say Satan, right? Not to be confused with our Satan. Totally different concept. Satan is an independent entity of God, has his own control, has his own shlita, has his own dominion that the Christianity calls hell. How long do you spend in hell according to Christianity?
Forever.
I guess forever, eternity, right? But there's no particular amount of time. You could be there forever. Very different than our concept of Gehenna. Our concept of Gehenna, very well said, is a cleansing process. Gehenna is a kapara. Gehenna is where a neshama goes, because sometimes people leave this world with an incredible amount of negative baggage. That negative baggage prevents them from going to Gan Eden, to Olam Haba, which is, you can't use Gan Eden anymore, which is Olam Haba, right? Prevents them from going to Olam Haba. And so Gehenna is the place where the neshama goes to undergo a cleansing process. What's the maximum sentence in Gehenna?
12 months.
Now, the truth is, there are exceptions to that rule as well. We say, Mishpat Rishon Gehenna Yud Beis Chodesh, that again, generally, even if a person is a Rasha, so Gehenna only lasts for 12 months, which is very important, because this is why we have a... Yes?
How is that possible? There's no time in...
There must be some amount of time. There must be some marking of time. I'll tell you this exactly my next statement, which is, this is the concept we recite Kaddish for 11 months. Why do we recite Kaddish for 11 months? What's the point of Kaddish, recitation of Kaddish? It's an aliyah for the neshama. That's the goal. Why do we recite Kaddish for 11 months and not 12 months? Right? Remember, again, you know that in the halachos of mourning, right, specifically for a parent, so mourning goes on for a total period of 12 months. Longest duration of mourning is for a parent. Right? 12 months come, the yartzeit comes. Amazingly enough, we stop Kaddish, children stop Kaddish, a month before the 12 months. Why? Excellent. Because to recite Kaddish for 12 months would almost be a declarative statement that the person whom I am stating Kaddish for is a Rasha. The whole idea of Kaddish, the kind of unspoken piece of Kaddish, is it's an aliyah for the neshama. But what's the great unknown when a person passes away? The great unknown? Where they're going. Right now, remember again, we're going to discuss this. Even by great tzaddikim, the truth is, no one knows what happens in the private life of an individual. No one knows what happens in the heart of an individual. And after 120, when a person leaves this world, of course, every Jew has a cheskas kashrus, right? A presumption of righteousness and good when they're alive, and of course, when they're dead. But at the end of the day, I don't know where my loved ones are going. It's not my business. That's between them and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. My business is to give the neshama an aliyah. So what do? I recite Kaddish. We learn. We do all different types of things. The goal of the Kaddish, ultimately, is to go out and lift up the neshama. We only recite it for 11 months out of a declaration, out of an assumption that even if the neshama had to spend some time in Gehenna, it's not 11 months. It's right, or I should say, it's not 12 months. Because 12 months, that's the amount of time for Rishayim. So take something interesting. There's a fascinating shaila in the poskim. What happens if a person has a parent and the person knows the parent was a Rasha? Right? Reuven knows his father was a Rasha. How could Reuven know his father was a Rasha? So the truth is, it's hard to know if anybody's really a Rasha, but he lived the life and he did things which would categorize him as a Rasha. Again, did he do tshuva? Did he not do tshuva? So it's an interesting discussion in the postgame. Are you allowed to say Kaddish for that 12th month if I know my parent was a Rasha? So this is an incredible machlokes. So many poskim say no, because the truth is you don't know if someone's a tzaddik or a Rasha, so you can't do that. Others say that here's the fundamental distinction. If you know your parent was a Rasha, but the world doesn't, so then you can't say Kaddish for that 12th month. But if it was known that the parent was a Rasha, the parent conducted himself in a way that it was Yadua Lakol, is the Lashon HaPoskim. Everyone knows that he or she was a Rasha, one would be permitted to say Kaddish for that 12th month. Just an interesting aside. So this is very important, because Gehenna, you see, the truth is this goes to a fundamental Yisod in Yiddishkeit, which is, in general, when you look at punishments in Judaism, what is the nature of our punishment code? What's the nature? What's the goal of a punishment?
To teach
and?
Kapara.
To atone and? Rehabilitate. The goal of a punishment is not punitive. The goal of a punishment, ultimately, again, is atonement, rehabilitation, and some type of lesson. That's why, interestingly enough, right, in our judicial system, in the Judaic penal code, right, in our punishment system, what don't we have?
Jail.
Did we speak about this once before? I'm sorry? Okay. No jail, right? Amazing enough, the only time we find jail in the entire Torah is where? Exactly. Vayimicheba mishmar, kiloparashmaya asela, by the makalel, by the makoshesh. The only time that anybody was ever imprisoned was when it was not known what to do with them. So the individual who was mechalo Shabbos befarhesia, he desecrated Shabbos publicly in the desert, Moshe doesn't know what to do with him. The guy who's a mechalo curses HaKadosh Baruch Hu in public, Moshe doesn't know what to do with him. In those situations where we don't know what to do with someone, we put them in a cell until HaKadosh Baruch Hu instructs us what to do. But never in, it's amazing, nowhere do we have the concept of a prison. Why? Because it's not helpful. Meaning society grapples with this contemporarily, that we recognize now that locking people in a cell for prolonged periods of time does not help them. In fact, it only hurts them. One of the greatest challenges of the criminal system today is the fact that you can imprison people, what they call the reticence rate, which means that someone gets released from prison, the probability that they're going to commit a crime again is infinitely higher after incarceration than it was before. Why? Because if you cage people like animals, what do they become?
Animals.
This is the way that is. Yes? So, okay, so there definitely could be a concept like that, but that's why, what do we do for the protection of society? What do we, so it's an excellent point. So, let's say someone is a dangerous society, what do we do with them? Yeah, it doesn't sound so great. But that, by the way, what's the paradigmatic example of that? The most dramatic example of that?
Amalek.
Okay, even more dramatic than Amalek. Ben Sora Remora. Remember again, just to say how far we take this, Ben Sora Remora is executed. Why? Why? Because he make, remember again, Ben Sora Remora has not, what do you have to do to become Ben Sora Remora? Right? So, all right. On a most basic level, you have to steal money for meat and for wine. Again, there are more technicalities, but that's the issue. Whatever it is, nothing that Ben Sora Remora does is an executable offense. He has not done anything that would warrant executing him. So why do we kill him? Why do you kill the Ben Sora Mora? Right? Al Shem Sofo, like Rashi says. Because what's going to happen? If he's this gluttonous when he's young and he's stealing from his parents to support his habits, he's going to become the kind of person who's going to stand by the crossroads, umelastem es abrios, and he's going to become a public menace. So you're 1,000% right. In fact, we take a harder stance on someone who's a public menace. Even the menace who is not yet a public menace, but will become a public menace, we execute him. So the truth is, 100%, it seems to be that from a Judaic perspective, we would rather execute someone who is a public danger than put them in a cell. For two reasons. Number one, the execution itself is what? Well, it's permanent, that is true, right? But it's a kapara, right? It is permanent, right? And it is a kapara, right? At least it does something for the neshama of the person. And also, by the way, there's another issue, right? What's the greatest challenge with running a prison system? I'm sorry? So first of all, they learn from each other. You're locking up a bunch of bad people under one roof. It's not the pshat, like they're gonna start like a gimach, or like they're gonna start like a chesed campaign. Chances are they're gonna, what else? Excellent. It's a waste of resources. Right? This is an incredible idea as well. Remember again, this is something, not our topic, but it happens to be fascinating, which is how in Judaism we view communal resources and how careful we are with communal resources. Give me an example, totally unrelated to our topic, but give me an example of somewhere where we see that sometimes even the needs of the individual are set aside for the purpose of preserving communal resources. A difficult question. I'm sorry? Shumos and Maestros, why? What do you mean by that? Good, good, that's true. That's more like individual. Good. Good, where everybody's giving. Good. Where do you see the community's money? Grouped money. This comes up, by the way, again, not our topic, but I'll give you a little bit of a taste of it. Pidyon Shvuyim. There is an incredible concept by Pidyon Shvuyim. Pidyon Shvuyim is an incredible mitzvah. An incredible mitzvah. What? So the Gemara Maseches Gin, the Mishnah Maseches Gin says, Ein poldin es hashvuyin yosem nikidei d'mehen. We do not redeem captives for more than their worth. In other words, we'll redeem captives, but not if the captor is asking an exorbitant amount of money. Now, how you define the worth of an individual is a more complicated discussion. But the halacha is a halacha. You are not permitted to redeem a captive for more than their worth. Why not? Why not? Because what ends up happening is you're going to create then a market for this. Then the nations around us will capture Jews, will kidnap Jews, knowing that Jews are willing to go ahead and pay for anything and everything, and it's going to incentivize kidnappings. Mm-hmm. By the way, what were two of the most high-profile cases of this halacha?
The Arba.
Right, the Maharam of Rotenberg. Right, excellent. The Maharam of Rotenberg was taken captive and ordered the community not to ransom him. The Maharam of Rotenberg died in captivity. It was only years later they were able to get his body back for burial, and they did not. And again, he ordered. They were willing to raise all the money in the world. The Maharam forbade it. He asserted it. He said, "Do not redeem me." And again, his tshuva on this topic is one of the most important pieces of halakhic literature. Where else? More contemporarily. This came up not even so long ago. So Holocaust, good that they came up, true, but in the individual, with Gilad Shalit. Anyone remember the Gilad Shalit episode, right? The IDF soldier who was captured by Islamic terrorists. There was a whole discussion, there was a whole vikuach in Eretz Yisrael about this. When it came time, the possibility for a swap for him, there was a whole camp that, of course, wanted Gilad Shalit to come back home. But many felt that the price that was being asked was simply too high. And if you pay whatever the terrorists want, you are incentivizing further kidnappings. Baruch Hashem, he was able to come home. But we know, for example, many of the terrorists that were released with that prisoner swap went on to commit more crimes. So again, you see this idea of communal resources. So tying this back a little bit, how do we get into prisons? So that's why, again, you would see also just from an economics perspective, the need to go ahead and support a system like that, that doesn't really help, that doesn't do anything, is antithetical to Yiddishkeit. Yes?
But in terms of the death sentence, we require a lot of conditions met to actually...
100%.
We would still end up with the problem with having people who should be not part of society, still part of society.
So you're asking more of a historical question. How they actually, you're asking, the fact is we know that as much as there are so many death sentences handed down in the Torah, right, the Gemara says that a Beis Din executed someone once every 70 years. It was called the Mashchis. So you're asking good, you're asking a sociological question with historically, how did they deal with people who were a danger to society? I don't know the answer. I don't know, it's like a historical question. What did they actually do? We don't have recorded episodes of prisons or accounts of prisons. So how do they do it? Did they administer other types of punishments? Remember, Beis Din in general has wide sweeping authorities. Even aside death sentence, they have the ability to administer other punishments. They have the ability to seize assets. So maybe there are other ways that they dealt with communal threats. I don't know. It's a very good question. So coming back to Gehenna now, this is very important because in Yiddishkeit, all of our punishments, nothing is punitive. You know, the one area of punitive punishment we have is in the area of monetary law, right? We do have a punitive monetary punishment. It's called a knas. What's a knas? Knas is a penalty payment. In halacha, there are two different types of monetary payments. There's what's called mamon, which is we'll call monetary restitution, and then there's knas, there's a penalty payment. Right? So meaning, just on a simple level, a person goes ahead and steals a sheep. What's the halacha when you steal a sheep? What do you have to pay?
Double.
Right? You have to pay four times the value of the sheep. Four times. Why? Why do I pay four times the value of the sheep? Maybe once, maybe twice, kefal, four times. It's knas. It's a penalty payment. So there are certain, so aside from monetary law, where you do have punitive penalty payments, even those penalty payments, there's a svara for them. In general, punishment in Judaism is supposed to be rehabilitative, educational, and cathartic. So the paradigmatic example of cathartic rehabilitative punishment is Gehenna. Gehenna. Kadosh Baruch Hu doesn't send the Shamas to Gehenna just to get a patch. Now I want to point out, there are Shaim who spend eternity in Gehenna. We're not talking about them, right? Those are the outliers. The normative case that we're speaking about over here is Gehenna that maybe even many Jewish neshamas undergo as a form of cleansing process, whether it's for a day, whether it's for a week, whether it's for 11 months, whether it's for 12 months. But the goal of Gehenna is what? What's the goal? Right? The goal is cleanse, go to Olam Haba. That is the goal. So this is very important to frame this. So Gehenna. So let's analyze this for a little bit. So the question we have to begin by dealing with is, what is Gehenna? Right? Meaning, what is it? So I'll give you, take a look at number two. So I'll show you a couple of very interesting Gemaras. Take a look at number two, the Gemaras. Tana Rabbanan. Hameratze ma'os li'isha miyado liyada kedei lehistakel ba. So literally translates, if a man who counts money for a woman from his hand to her hand in order to look at her. So what is the Gemara describing over here? What is the Gemara describing?
A merchant.
I'm sorry?
A merchant who is the woman in the marketplace and he wants and he's like, he's looking at her.
Good. What he's using over here is he's using a pretext to look at a woman inappropriately. That's what's happening over here. Right? Meaning, again, it's not the pshat that he's engaged in a transaction. He's using the transaction as an excuse to do something that is inappropriate. Now, is he performing an inappropriate act? So on a technical level, no. Right? There's no like illicit relationship that is occurring over here. It's lehistakel ba. He has a desire to look at her. Now again, an act of a man looking at a woman who's not his wife, or in an inappropriate way, is of course asur. The nature of that isur is los asuru acharei. Right? The Torah even tells us that we're not supposed to veer after our eyes. But I just want to point out something very important over here. He is not committing a physical moral act. He is looking in an inappropriate way. Look what the Gemara says. Afilu yesh biyado Torah umaisim tovim kimosh rabbeinu. This is an overwhelming Gemara. Even if such a man has in his hand Torah, which learning, Ma'asim Tovim, good deeds, Kimosh Rabbeinu, Lo Yinake Medina Shel Gehenna. He will not, now what does that mean, Lo Yinake Medina Shel Gehenna, what does that mean? It's not a trick question. What does it mean? Right, he will not escape Gehenna. He will not escape Kenem. Shenemar, Yad Liad Lo Yinake Ra, Lo Yinake Medina Shogam. Now, of course, this Gemara, when it says Lo Yinake Medina Shogam, what is that presupposing? That he does not do what? Tshuva. right? This Gemara is independent of tshuva. Obviously, a person could do tshuva, and tshuva has the ability to erase everything, right? Remember again, the power of tshuva is on one level zedonos naas es lo kishgagos, and on a higher level zedonos naas es lo kizichuyos. The ability of tshuva to transform even the most negative of actions into something even potentially positive is quite dramatic. So this Gemara is talking about in a vacuum. A man does this, doesn't do tshuva, lo yinachim dinu shel gerim. Yes.
Just a technical question. After someone is nifter, are they going sins that they did before, just for this past year, like after Yom Kippur, or they have to have an additional kapara on things that they're apparently
given for? It's an excellent question. I don't know. You're asking how HaKadosh Baruch Hu like judges the neshamas. I don't know. Meaning, is there kapara just for whatever happened from the last Yom Kippur, or is there some type of kapara necessary beforehand? Excellent question. I don't know.
Because didn't we discuss in this class that we should do teshuva from things that we didn't even do this year? Because it could be that one of the two reasons.
Right.
So it seems to imply that we...
That the neshama, there's some level of responsibility. Yeah, but it could also be... The one part that we're not focusing on over here is there is, even in Olam Haba, there are different levels. So it's possible that sometimes the way the neshama attains its purity is lav dafka in Gehenna. But sometimes it just doesn't get the highest level of Olam Haba immediately, and then the kapara is addressed that way as well. But the simple answer to your question is, I don't know. That's how HaKadosh Baruch Hu judges the neshamas. I'm not sure. So what do you see over here? So why am I bringing you down this Gemara? Because you begin to see from this Gemara, reinforcing what we just said before. What's the point of Gehenna? What? Kapara. Right, see here the Gemara is describing someone who did something wrong. This is wrong. Now, leaving aside, by the way, that the Gemara seems to be speaking in such a severe way about someone who didn't even physically do anything wrong. We're not describing over here a person who engaged in an illicit relationship. We're talking about a maisa of histaklus. So why? Our topic is not today why Chazal would deal so severely with the maisa of histaklus, of looking. That's not our topic. My point over here is I just want to show you in Chazal's worldview what Gehenna was there for. So Gehenna was there to take care of the culpability, liability, iniquity of this particular man. Another example, number three. The Imam Masechet Shabbos says, Amar Rav Shila, Amar Rav Chista, Kol HaMenavel Es Piv. What does it mean, Kol HaMenavel Es Piv? Speaks nivel peh, right? So, without getting into the actual definition of that, abuses his koach haloshen, abuses speech. What did the Gemara say? Ma'amikin lo gehenim. Ultimately, now, what does that loshen mean? Ma'amikin lo gehenim. I'm sorry. Deepens. So that loshen is fascinating. What does that tell you about gehenim? There are levels. There are levels, which makes sense, because the same way that there are levels in Olam Haba. Remember again, Olam Haba and Gehenna are—they're not even two sides of the same coin. They're the same continuum, right? Even for those in Gehenna, the goal is to get to Olam Haba. Gehenna is just the purification process through which the neshama ultimately is able to get to where it really needs to spend eternity. But it's interesting that there are levels. What those levels mean, I'm not sure, but there are levels. Yes. Ma'amikin, to deepen.
So is it worse than the first one?
You mean comparing two to three? I didn't think about that. I guess so. I guess lo yinakim medina shel gehenam is less severe than ma'amikin lo gehenam. I don't know. I'd have to think about that. That maybe Chazal's view of someone who's menabel is piv is even worse than an episode of histaklus. It's an excellent diuk. It definitely sounds like ma'amikin is worse. You're digging a deeper Gehenna for yourself. Yes.
If there's different levels for Gani, whatever, Olam Haba, so why can't we say Kaddish for longer and forget?
Push higher. So it seems to be that the essence of Kaddish, as Chazal instituted it, was really to get people out of Gehenna. That was the institution of Kaddish was for that purpose. You say, why didn't they institute Kaddish to pull for? I don't know. That just seems to be.
That could be also from a lower, like the lower level.
What do you mean it's not for an aliyah for the neshama?
Because then that could also be someone like And it's like just saying, just from like that point of Gehenna.
So that seems to be when a person, when the neshama leaves this world, it almost seems like the greatest existential fear for the neshama is the neshama in Gehenna? And so like we're preoccupied with making sure if that neshama is in Gehenna, let's get it out. Let's get it out. It almost seems like we're not as worried if it's in a lower piece of Olam Haba getting to a higher piece. Although we occupy ourselves, that's a yard site. Remember again, what's the significance of a yard site? Very important. Anniversary of death. Why is it such a significance? You know, there's a very interesting distinction between the way Misnagdim and Hasidim observe a yard site. Right? Often by Misnagdim, a yard site is observed how? Seen, but it's often a somber thing. By Hasidim, you ever see Hasidim observe a yard site? Truth is, you see this much more in Eretz Yisrael. If you ever see like a group of Hasidim on a yard site by a kever, what are they often doing by the kever? Right, dancing around. You can even see them like a little bit like making a l'chaim, which is like a very strange thing. Like it looks very strange. Not right by the kever, a little bit away. By Hasidim, there's the concept that the yard site is actually an incredible simcha, because the neshama goes higher and higher and higher. The significance of a yard site is that we believe the neshama has gone higher. But yes, it seems the Chazal's preoccupation with Kaddish was in the event that it's neshama's in Gehenna, get it out. Which, by the way, just as an aside, the tour happens to bring down an opinion, a fascinating opinion, that even for an Avel, even for a mourner who's saying Kaddish, so the tour brings down an opinion, we don't pass in this way, that an Avel doesn't have to say Kaddish on Shabbos. Why not? So the Gemara, the Torah calls an amazing Gemara, that what happens on Shabbos in Gehenna, apparently it's like an off Shabbos, right? It's like a furlough, right? Even the neshamas are released from Gehenna on Shabbos, and even those neshamas ultimately, again, who have to be in Gehenna Shabbos, I don't know where they go, but I guess maybe Olam Habo or somewhere just outside of Gehenna. So this guy said, that's why there's an element also of a sadness on Matzah Shabbos, because the concept of Matzah Shabbos, we often assume the sadness of Shabbos is over, but on a celestial level, the neshamas that are in Gehenna are going back to Gehenna. So just, again, an interesting idea. So if you take a look at 3 and 4, the idea over here is that Gehenna is where you go to ultimately, again, atone for your wrongful acts. It's where you go. You've done something wrong in this world. It's where there's an accounting of your wrongful deeds. Interestingly enough, if you take a look at number 5, so the Gemara Maseches Erevin writes as follows. Shlosha psachim yesh l'gehenam. There are 3 different openings to Gehenna. 2 different openings. Where are 3 different openings. Echad b'midbar, ve'echad b'yam, ve'echad b'Yerushalayim. It's really fascinating, right? 3 openings to Gehenna. So by the way, the imagery, of course, that the Gemara is employing over is, where is Gehenna? Where is Gehenna? Down. Right? So remember again, just in the construct of our minds, we often have this idea, Olam Haba is up, Gehenna is down. Now we're going to see this is much more metaphorical than anything else. How do you know that it's metaphorical?
Because in the actual physical earth, there's just...
Right, because that... Now, again, by the way, you can begin to understand also why in other religions there is this notion of Gehenna being fire. Again, we also have allusions to Gehenna being fire. But this idea, especially if you understand it down, so down, you can understand earth's core, heat. But again, I just want to point out, this is metaphorical. Because remember, we're talking about neshamas. When it comes to neshamas, ultimately, again, Gan Eden and Gehenna, or I should say Olam Haba and Gehenna, exist apart from the earthly world. But nevertheless, you'll see what the message is. So the Gemara says, 3 entranceways to Gehenna. In the Midbar, in the sea, and in Yerushalayim. But Midbar, the Chsiv, Vayer Duhem V'chala Sherlahem Chaim Sha'ola. That's a reference to who? Korach, excellent. Bayam the Chsiv, Mibaten Shol Shavati Shamata Koli. That's Yonah. B'Yerushalayim the Chsiv, Nu'um Hashem Asher Arlo B'tzion V'tanro Lo B'Yerushalayim. So the Gemara goes on. We'll skip a little bit. Good. So, all right. Well, if you skip down to the last line. So the Gemara says, so first of all, just as an interesting aside, what do you think is the message of Chazal when they say that there are three entrances to get. Remember again, whenever you see a Gemara like this, you could understand it literally if you want to, but you could also understand it as a profound metaphor. What's the metaphor with having three entranceways to Yerushalayim? One in the desert, one in the sea, and one in Yerushalayim. What would you say? Any thoughts? Yes.
Maybe it's saying there's three ways to get to Gehenna, like three things you could do wrong that could deserve you of doing it to get in.
Good. Like what?
I don't know. The Gemara.
Okay. Good. It could be three different ways in which a person ends up. Again, I'm good.
I would assume the Midbar and the Mayim are in Eretz Yisrael, so probably it's alluding to the fact that we're in Gaul, so we have to first go to Eretz Yisrael and then go.
Say that once more. So Yerushalayim is Eretz Yisrael, Midbar is Eretz Yisrael. So you say once more.
All three of them are Eretz Yisrael.
Okay.
I mean, this part I'm
good. Good.
So either it's saying that we would have to everything like Eretz Yisrael is a source of life, so we have to Hashem has to travel with Eretz Yisrael first, and then make its way to wherever it's going.
Beautiful.
I mean, I don't have a source, but
beautiful. Sounds good. Sounds good.
It brings down the path from Korach, and Korach wasn't in the middle.
So maybe under the ground he traveled.
Right, now I might get a little bit of a stretch, right? Yes. But good, beautiful. Meaning there is this incredible interface. It's very important between Kedusha, because again you have Yerushalayim, which is the paradigmatic example of Kedusha. You have the Yam and the Midbar. The Yam and the Midbar. Really, what's come down between Yam and Midbar? I know that sounds strange, right? They sound like opposites, but what do they have in common? What? They're both what? They're both vast, right? So it's just quite interesting. You're going to see, I'm not going to tell you the answer right now, we're going to see the symbolisms in this. But there's incredible symbolism in this idea that Gehenna, there's an interesting to Gehenna in Yerushalayim. What does that mean? So of course, on the most basic level, one of the major messages that emerges from this is that sometimes, what are they saying? There's a famous expression like this, that... How does it go? The pathway to hell is paved with good intentions. You ever hear this expression? Right? So the truth is, the idea that there's an entranceway to Gehenna in Yerushalayim is this incredible idea that even people sometimes who think that what they're doing is L'shem Shamayim, what they're doing is wonderful, what they're doing is great, what they're doing is sacred, sometimes don't even realize that in fact they're paving the way to Gehenna. There's an entranceway to Gehenna, even by Yerushalayim. By the way, the rest of the Gemara actually goes on that it's actually quite possible that the entranceway to Gehenna might even be opposite Har Abayis. Again, the sea and the desert represent vastness. We're going to come back to this, but I'll just say this just quickly. What does it represent? It represents the idea that the surest way to get to Gehenna in life, I know no one wants to get there, but the surest way to get to Gehenna is how? To be rudderless and directionless. You see, people who don't have a plan in life, people who don't have a direction in life, where do I want to go? What do I want to be? Who do I want to become? What do I want to accomplish? Unfortunately, end up in Gehenna. What happens if you get on the high seas and you don't know where you're going? Bad news. You go to the desert and you don't know where you're going? Good. Bad news. Right? The idea over here is that if you walk into these vast spaces and you don't have a direction, you don't have a direction in life, then at the end of the day, unfortunately, that leads to Gehenna. So almost like this incredible double message. Always, number one in life, check yourself. Because even if you think that your machshavas al Hashem Shamayim, even if you think your kavanas afar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, even if you think you're in Yerushalayim, make sure you're heading down the right path in life. Because sometimes the things we think are good, the things we think are holy, may in fact not be so. And number two, when you enter into life, as you go into the vast desert of life, the vast ocean of life, make sure that you have a direction, because without it, you'll end up lost. Without a direction, ultimately, again, all paths lead to Gehenna. All right, you know, we're going to stop over here for today. We're going to pick up Meretz Hashem with the Gemara Maseches Pesachim on number 6, defining a bit more as to what exactly is Gehenna, and then Meretz Hashem trying to figure out then what is the message of Gehenna.